The book I wrote this time was designed for Americans. I think we are, as a nation, in a situation of danger that we really haven't quite grasped yet. So my talk this morning is just simply called America on the Road to Defeat, a presidential campaign without foreign policy debate.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Michael Scheuer is a 20-plus year veteran of the CIA. From 1996 to 1999, he served as the chief of the Osama bin Laden tracking unit at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. He then acted as a special advisor to the chief from September 2001 to November 2004, when he retired from the agency. Michael Scheuer is currently an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Jamestown Foundation. He wrote Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America. And his second book, the New York Times bestseller, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, wrote both of those using the name Anonymous because he was still employed by the agency. His most recent book, Marching Towards Hell, America and Islam After Iraq, will be on sale outside following the forum. Please join me in welcoming Michael Scheuer.
Good morning, everyone. It is genuinely a pleasure for me to be here. I appreciated the invitation. I thought it might be rescinded. I was telling Mr. Gillum that after the New York Times Sunday Review appeared, it wasn't quite clear to my wife whether I was in her own species. So she sent me out for a DNA test, and I passed. So I was glad you didn't ask for the same proof. I thought the book I wrote this time was designed, as all of my books have been, for Americans. I think we are, as a nation, in a situation of danger that we really haven't quite grasped yet. And I had hoped that there would be a debate on foreign policy that had at least some substance to it. And it occurs to me at this date, after a year of campaigning, that we have not had that yet. My talk this morning is just simply called America on the Road to Defeat, a presidential campaign without foreign policy debate. Despite the seemingly endless nature of the presidential primaries and now the run-up to the general election, the presidential candidates, when there were 20 in the field and now that there are only two, and most of the media have ensured that Americans have not heard anything remotely resembling a substantive foreign policy debate. While we have heard quirky and frankly silly assertions that sleeping with a president, suffering as a prisoner of war, and setting records for using the word change constitute adequate commander-in-chief training, we have little tangible idea of what the two remaining candidates would do in the field of international affairs, saving being reassured that someone will answer the phone at 3 a.m. Let me suggest that there has been no such debate because the candidates do not want one. Why? Well, because there are no substantive differences other than matters of tone and shades of nuance regarding foreign policy between the two candidates or any of those now fallen by the wayside. Each is a rank and reckless interventionist. Note that each took time out from the campaigning to applaud the independence of Kosovo from Serbia, in which Washington and the feckless European Union have lit the fuse for the next Balkans war, and as well as to approve the expansion of NATO, so that now America is committed to defend the sovereignty, if you can believe such a ridiculous thing, of Albania and Bulgaria. More troubling, the campaign's foreign policy silence is based on each candidate's intention to maintain the now 35-year-old status quo in U.S. foreign policies toward the Muslim world, the impact of which is the single greatest force that motivates our Islamist enemies. This reality should disturb all Americans, but it should especially worry young Americans. For the maintenance of the status quo policies in the Muslim world means more war and almost inevitably the reintroduction of conscription. In mid-February, I published a book called Marching Toward Hell, which tried to lay out for Americans the dangers to our country that have accumulated because of the relentless interventionism of their bipartisan governing elite. My book suggests those who think our Muslim world policies will end when Mr. Bush returns to his Texas ranch are badly mistaken, and that the next presidential term will see nothing but more war and escalating human and economic damage resulting from the interventionism both parties preach as if it is divine scripture. In short, 4 years hence, Americans will be seeing their children's lives and the outrageous taxes they pay being continually wasted in other people's wars, especially other people's religious wars, in which no genuine U.S. national interest is at stake. Although you would not know it from the candidate's rhetoric, nothing less than U.S. national security and the financial sovereignty of America are at risk in the years ahead. The reception my book is getting from the elite press has given me a small taste of the treatment that Dr. Ron Paul received at the hands, at its hands, and those of his fellow candidates when he suggested that America was attacked on 9/11 because of what the U.S. does in the Muslim world and not for how Americans live and think at home. Some reviews have taken a serious look at the book's argument, agreeing on some, questioning others, but the New York Times Sunday Review discussed nothing in the book, simply denouncing it as me and me as crude, simplistic, implicitly unpatriotic and Machiavellian, and assigning it to that netherworld that Alexis de Tocqueville described as being outside the closed circle of permissible debate in America. After reading the review, I thought, now I know a bit about how Dr. Paul felt when Rudy Giuliani struck his talented Mussolini pose and denounced Paul's precisely true statement that U.S. policy in the Muslim world motivated the 9/11 attackers and is motivating the growing millions of our Islamist foes. Interventionism, it seems, is a holy gospel for our political class. To question the gospel is treason and excludes the questioner from public debate. Well, perhaps interventionism is so deeply ingrained in the U.S. governing elite and its media and academic supporters that the issue cannot be taken on whole. It is, after all, a broad and multifaceted topic. Raising opposition to it as a whole allows men like El Duce Giuliani to avoid specifics and assail non-interventionists as appeasers and blame America firsters. Perhaps the best non-interventionists can do in this presidential cycle is to ask a limited number of specific questions, which, if answered honestly, would show Americans how poorly their interventionist leaders are protecting them and how the defense of America is nowhere near a top priority for Senator McCain and Obama, Senators McCain and Obama, despite their rhetoric. There are many obvious foreign policy-related questions to be asked of the two senators, but the media, for the most part, has not and probably will not do so. As long as the media, left, center, and right, neglect their duty to ask pointedly specific foreign policy questions, the candidates are free to prattle on and call for universal health care, job creation programs, tax cuts or increases, and other domestic initiatives. Talk about domestic projects that will ease the economic downturn is palliative, but empty talk. The past, present, and future costs of the interventionism championed by both parties preclude massive domestic expenditures. The candidates know this, but they will remain silent until after the inauguration, unless the media steps up to the plate and asks the questions that need answering. Certainly, other people could ask better questions than I can. But there are 10 specific questions that reflect the concerns I outlined at length in Marching Toward Hell. I think each merits a full and frank response from our two would-be presidents. Each is followed by a proposed answer, a form of which we really ought to hear if the candidate understands the threats America faces from its Islamist enemies and perhaps, more important, from its own legacy of failed and counterproductive foreign policies. The first question I would suggest is, why are we fighting much of the Muslim world, and what is our enemy's motivation? The answer, as always, the truth is the place to start. We must accept that the United States government is seen as the mortal foe of Islam and Muslims, because of the impact of its foreign policies. We need not don sackcloth and ashes, nor immediately abandon policies motivating bin Laden, al-Qaeda, and their allies. But no nation state should keep bankrupt policies out of fear of having changes be seen as appeasement. We must deal with the world as it is, not as we would like it. We are hated for what we do, not who we are. Armed with this vital understanding, we can define the talented, pious, and growing foe we confront, start to alter counterproductive policies, and begin crafting military plans that can protect America better than a policy of arresting the terrorists one man at a time. Second, given the tax burden Americans shoulder for defense, why is the U.S. military not winning? Quite simply, because we have not killed enough of the enemy. We must change the rules of engagement for U.S. soldiers and Marines, rules which currently make them targets and not killers, and which are based on U.S. leaders' fear of media and foreign criticism. In the few cases where America must fight, the military needs to make U.S. might felt to whatever extent is needed for victory. This includes death and destruction broad enough to make the local populations giving indispensable support to our enemies demand peace. It wastes U.S. lives and is fatal to our security to go to war if we do not mean to win. Without this change, moreover, nation-building programs are useless. History, as well as our current Afghan and Iraqi nightmares, show durable nation-building is impossible if the enemy is not first definitively defeated. The advocates of so-called soft power portray it as an alternative to military power. This is nonsense. Soft power worked after World War II because Germany and Imperial Japan were utterly devastated by U.S. hard power, and they knew it. Soft power worked in the Cold War because we operated in the peaceful environment engendered by mutually assured destruction, and because the Soviet Union was a malignant cancer of a society that could bring no credible soft power of its own to bear and to ward off our own. Neither of these scenarios prevails at the moment. The Islamists are wholly undefeated, and Islam is a vibrant and rapidly growing civilization. Third, can Americans really be safer if our ports and borders are virtually unguarded and police must cope with 11 plus million undocumented aliens? The short answer is no. We must stop the political and media posturing and whining and temporarily close our borders until we can gauge the internal threat. Until this is done, little of what we do against al-Qaeda and its allies overseas makes America safer. Indeed, the Islamists are America's most serious post-Civil War internal threat, precisely because of 35 years of negligent immigration and border control policies that are based on the unproven value of diversity and multiculturalism, rather than on America's essence, a respect and even reverence for the rule of law. Controlling immigration and borders has nothing to do with racial discrimination, human rights, or civil liberties. And it should have nothing to do with cowardly and self-serving politicians trolling for the Hispanic vote. Effective border control is first and foremost about national survival and giving law enforcement agencies at all levels of government a fighting chance to preempt the coming al-Qaeda attack without having to resort to extra constitutional procedures. And in weighing the issue of imposing effective border controls, it is too often forgotten that one of the surest results of a future al-Qaeda attack, more destructive than 9/11, will certainly be greatly enhanced frictions and animosities among America's diverse ethnic and religious groups as citizens become more suspicious and less trusting of each other in a scenario where they have just seen for the second time the federal government's inability to protect them here at home. Fourth question, why is U.S. energy security and the control of our debt in the hands of anti-American Arab tyrants 35 years after the first Saudi-led oil embargo? The obvious answer is that U.S. political leaders have chosen to follow the path of least resistance, which also is the most likely path to continual reelection. But we must now accelerate conversion to alternative energies, expand nuclear power, and further exploit U.S. fossil fuel reserves. When we celebrate Independence Day each year, few people note that our foreign energy dependence means that America has lost much of its independence over the most crucial foreign policy decision, whether or not to go to war. If a disaster occurs in Saudi Arabia's eastern province or in the Niger Delta in the Gulf of Guinea that severely curtails energy production, Washington will have no choice. It will go to war to restore that production. And if you think Iraq and Afghanistan are nightmares, wait until we have U.S. Marines fighting in the Niger Delta, which is 27,000 square kilometers of swamp and forest, and from which we will, by 2012, be receiving 20% of our imported crude oil. Nothing should deter America from gaining energy self-sufficiency. Demands for the absolute protection of Arctic hares or shrimp-inhabited reefs at the cost of dead Marines and soldiers should be ignored. Beyond oil, America has no national interest in the Arab Peninsula, save the freedom of navigation that the U.S. Navy can ensure. And as our energy dependence ends, this will be clear. Self-sufficiency will allow America to stop protecting the Gulf's tyrannies, which now cloud our economic destiny, export religious hatred for us, far more vitriolic than anything Bin Laden proffers, and makes our advocacy of freedom for all appear to be pure and even spectacular hypocrisy. It also will end the current and cruel reality that sees some portion of the price U.S. parents pay at the pump for gasoline flow from oil-rich Arabs to the Mujahideen who are killing their soldier children in Iraq and Afghanistan. Fifth, why does America back the major antagonists in the Arab-Israeli war, Saudi Arabia and Israel? And what are U.S. interests in the war beyond emotional ties to Israel and dependence on the Gulf government's oil and funding of the national debt? The beginning of wisdom is that we must keep out of other people's wars, and particularly their religious wars. America now stands as a major loser in the 2006 Israel-Hezbollah war, the Israel-Palestine conflict, and the economic strangling of Hamas. Indeed, America is in part losing to the Islamists because of its absolute backing of Israel and its terminal blind eye for the Saudis' blatant and aggressive jihad spreading around the world. America must withdraw from this savagery. We should define the settlement that suits us, call in both sides, and say 50 years of your brutal and selfish behavior is enough. Here's what we want implemented. If you don't, you are on your own and can kill each other to your heart's content. We also can tell the American people that Israel's underdog status ended when it went nuclear and built a now undocumented arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. Sixth, why is Washington supporting the Russian and Chinese campaigns to annihilate parts of their Muslim populations? The answer is because we tend to see our war with Islamists as a series of isolated conflicts and not as an integrated whole upon which issues we regard as unrelated nonetheless have a significant impact. This is the case with Russia and China. We therefore must stop building Muslim hatred for Americans by supporting the Russian campaign in the North Caucasus and the Chinese activities in Western China. Moscow will do what it must do to win in the North Caucasus because its territorial integrity and energy future are at stake there. Our rhetorical support for what Moscow calls its part of the global war on terrorism, however, deeply stains us in the Muslim world and brings no assistance to the Russians. In China, Beijing is conducting genocide against Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang province by flooding the Uyghur homeland with Han Chinese, exactly as it is doing in Tibet. There is no reason for America to support this silent genocide by inundation, which currently is being underscored for Muslims by our threats of an Olympic boycott over Tibet and our absolute silence about Beijing's murderous campaign against the Uyghur Muslims. Today, we are very publicly making Bin Laden's point for him. The rhetoric of Washington and its allies in defense of Tibet coupled with its silence over the Uyghurs, is perceived by Muslims as yet more proof of bin Laden's contention that the West considers the lives of Muslims to be worthless and will do little to protect them. Seventh, why has the U.S. government failed since 1991 to secure the former Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal, leaving a chance for an Islamist nuclear attack in America? Quite frankly, there is no sane, reasonable, or responsible explanation for this appalling fact. It is a willful and quite possibly calamitous failure of foresight and leadership by the last two administrations. We must fast complete the program to help the Russians secure the former Soviet Union's 22,000 nuclear devices, an effort that has been reduced by the last two administrations. Full security for those weapons is infinitely more vital than haranguing the Russians about their failure to build a Western democracy. 17 years after the USSR's dissolution, Senator Lugar, the co-sponsor of the U.S.-Russian control program, says success is still far off. Thus, al-Qaeda has had a 17-year window to procure a weapon it has sworn to use in the United States and for which it has religious sanction to kill 10 million Americans. Eighth, with talk about war with Iran again in the air, why has no binding Senate resolution been passed to forbid this president and all future presidents from starting premeditated offensive conflicts without the formal declaration of war by Congress that the Constitution requires? The only accurate question is that the Congress has been derelict on this issue. We must force the Congress to end its willing abdication to the executive of its sole power to declare war by electing representatives pledged to restore constitutionality and therefore sanity to our war-making process. Infamously, no Congress has declared war since December 8, 1941, and yet we have repeatedly seen the American people dragged into wars because one man and his advisors have decided it is the right thing to do. Resolutions allowing the president to use military force offensively are cowardly acts that surrender constitutional prerogatives in a manner that allows senators and congressmen to have it both ways. They can applaud the troops if the war goes well, or they can snipe at and undermine the president if the war goes belly up. Our post-war history is littered with failed wars that were initiated by the president and which divided Americans amongst themselves. Perhaps the restoration of the founders' intent on the issue of war making will allow us both to win wars abroad and not to wage them against each other at home. Ninth, with Senator McCain stating that it is obvious that a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq would place Israel in grave danger, and having had both he and Senator Obama publicly pledge to protect Israel's security as if, as Senator Obama said, it is a sacred duty, is there any real chance of U.S. forces leaving Iraq in the foreseeable future? Obviously not. The Piper's bill is now coming due for our political class's patently absurd and even mindless contention that U.S. and Israeli national security interests are identical. America's Israel First neoconservatives in their journals, people like Doug Feith and Paul Wolfowitz, Norman Podoritz and William Kristol, Bernard Lewis and Victor Hansen, and such journals as the Weekly Standard, the National Review, and Commentary, also are now, with almost biblical justice, reaping the yield of the hubristic seeds they deliberately planted, namely, the idiot idea that a state could be created in Muslim Iraq that was not anti-Israeli and Israel's enemy. The reality is that Israel's national security was severely and permanently compromised from the moment the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq began. Moreover, it is not a fixable situation because a potentially pro-Israel regime in Iraq exists only in the ahistorical and fervid imaginings of the neoconservatives who are, when all is said and done, Israel's worst and most lethal enemies. The cost of unqualified and virtually unlimited support for Israel has heretofore been measured in the expenditure of dollars and political capital, and as such has been acquiesced in or ignored by Americans who are inured to to their federal government's prodigal waste of national resources. We now have transitioned into a situation where the cost of such support for Israel is now being measured in the blood and lives of the children of American parents. That cost quickly will become obvious, abhorrent, and utterly unacceptable to those parents. We are, I think, on the cusp of the unraveling of the U.S.-Israel relationship. And for whatever disasters that entails for the Jewish state, Israelis will have the neoconservatives and the U.S. politicians in both parties they manipulate to thank. Finally, why do the candidates claim to follow the founders' foreign policy advice when the founders so often warned that overseas intervention to build democracies would ultimately destroy our own republic? The answer, because they are lying. We must stop trying to spread democracy abroad by military, financial, humanitarian, or political intervention. No young American should die for the insane goal of giving the people of Iraq a possibility of embracing democracy, a phrase used ad infinitum by President Bush and other Western leaders. No small R Republican government like ours has the right to spend the lives of its young in military crusades for such patently unobtainable abstractions as gaining liberty, justice, and democracy for foreigners. U.S. foreign policy must revert to what it was before the anomaly called the Cold War gave license to U.S. politicians to become democracy-mongering interventionists. Foreign policy defends who we are. It does not and cannot define who we are. Foreign policy need do only one thing: protect America so as to allow the domestic expansion of liberty, freedom, and the equality of conditions. If no additional foreigner ever votes in an election, America would be no worse off. Washington's efforts to build democracies abroad has a track record of making America less safe, not more safe. And, may I add, is there a better definition of pure waste than spending the lives of our Marines or soldiers so Mrs. Mohammed can vote in an Afghan or Iraqi parliament? The post-Cold War democracy crusading U.S. administrations have impoverished us in treasure, in blood, domestic political unity, and what Abraham Lincoln once called the rightful influence of our Republican example. We must return to the founders' goal for America, to be the well-wisher of freedom, of independence for all, but the champion and vindicator only of our own. In closing, let me say that the current presidential cycle is not merely an exciting game over which the likes of Tim Russert and Chris Matthews and Katie Couric can banter, enthuse, and pontificate. We are electing this year from two very mediocre candidates, a president who will face unprecedented domestic threats from an enemy very unlike any we have previously fought. I believe that foreign policy is the ghost at the presidential campaign's banquet. All know that it is present, but everyone pretends not to see it. The questions above and myriad other better and more specific foreign policy questions must be repeatedly asked of the candidates until they give direct answers. My proposed answers clearly are not definitive, but any candidate that answers the queries above in an evasive or dismissive manner would show Americans his intention to continue the full intervention that is now bleeding America of lives, money, and political unity. And such a continuation will ultimately lead to a disaster for the future ability of Americans to live as they choose, and not in conditions imposed by national security threats that have long gone unaddressed and that now will no longer wait. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tell us what you really think, Mike.
I was raised by a Marine and educated by Jesuits, so I have a very deep and long-lasting failing, sir.
I am going to move to the back of the room, and I ask those of you who have questions, and I would guess that a few of you will have questions, to queue up in the back of the room, and we'll take as many as we have time for. To prime the pump, I'd like to ask Mr. Scheuer this. Is there any way we can scare or intimidate Osama bin Laden into surrendering? Are there any threats that we can make that would bring him to his knees? And would it make any difference?
I think we spoke earlier that you were a teacher or an instructor, professor of history here, and I think the way I would answer that is to say that America, as a great power, may be in a very unique position, maybe one that no other great power has faced. We have a very we have very little ability to intimidate what Al-Qaeda is, what it represents, and certainly not bin Laden. He and others don't mind the fact that we may kill them. But more importantly, we now face a situation where if America is attacked again on the level of 9/11 or a greater attack, we will be standing here surveying the damage, quivering with rage, and completely unable to respond with the world's greatest military against any target that counts. This is not a nation state we're facing. It doesn't have airports, it doesn't have industries, electrical grids, military barracks, airfields. The targets we could respond against, this administration probably would kick the Iranians, who would have nothing to do with it, or we could, others have suggested, we bomb their holy sites as a response. All of those are certainly doable by the United States, but all of them would make things worse for us. In the sense of uniting the enemy. So what I would say is that it's a very difficult thing to imagine how to intimidate these people. It's more hard to imagine why we haven't done more to defend ourselves here at home.
In your second point, you talk about the military's lack of success in some areas in Iraq. Can you comment further on some of the changes in terms of its rules of engagement that you are proposing?
Well, what I would propose is we suddenly become adults about war. We flatter ourselves that somehow we're better people than the Romans or the Greeks or the Americans of World War II even. And war, unfortunately, is at the end of the day about killing. And we're engaged in two insurgencies now against an enemy who does not wear uniforms, an enemy who lives amongst the civilian population, which either has been intimidated by him or more likely supports him. And the reality of that war is quite simple. That there will be enormous amounts of collateral damage, as we euphemistically call it, which means dead civilians. And if you have really just a couple choices, you can fight that war with all of the disaster and blood that entails, or you cannot fight the war, or you can do what we're doing in both places at the moment. Don't send enough troops, don't be aggressive enough, and ultimately bleed lives and money until you're forced to go home anyway. So my objection to Iraq is that we shouldn't have gone in the first place, but if we were going to go, we should have won. And we certainly have never had enough troops there to do it, and the fact that every time a civilian gets killed, we have to launch an investigation into why makes it very unlikely we will defeat this enemy with the world's most powerful military.
Why do you think the media and the critics have reacted so strongly to what you have to say?
You know, I think we have, there's several things in the discussion, public discussion of American foreign policy that have become holy writ. Free trade, for example. You can't have a discussion about free trade anymore because it is an unequivocal good at all times and all places. Interventionism has become, if you will, an American religion. We believe that we have to bring our way of life and our values and our political systems all the way around the world. So if anybody talks about non-intervention, that's never mentioned. It's mentioned as isolationism. Of course, America has never been an isolationist country. From the time of the founders forward, we have been a nation of traders. We've been involved with international activities in science and education and commerce, finance. they don't also like the reality that you have to kill a lot of people if you're going to fight wars. There is an ingrained sense, and as I teach people at Georgetown in the graduate school, I'm astounded continually by their ignorance of what war really means. It doesn't mean precision weapons. It doesn't mean separating the bad guys from the good guys. It means a lot of death. So I think I hit a lot of hot buttons in the current culture, things you don't want to talk about. Religion. This is a religious war we're involved in par excellence. If these people were using religion and didn't believe that they were fighting for their faith, if they were gangsters and just nihilists, they would be a lethal nuisance to us. They wouldn't be a security threat, a national security threat. But we see the presidents, both parties' presidents, continually, you know, Islam is a religion of peace. And it's true. All religions are a religion of peace. Until they believe themselves cornered or threatened. And then they respond in the way Islam is responding at the moment, or much of Islam is responding. So I guess I'm politically incorrect, and fundamentally I am a nationalist rather than an internationalist, and I think that's very out of vogue. And I don't have movie star good looks either, so that's that doesn't help.
Point I wanted to make is that you've spoken about a lot of these elements in the background that have contributed to the formation of this aura that, which we found ourselves in, okay? Which is, seems to be encouraged by the administration and by other forces in the background. Now, you mentioned the American-Israeli situation, which I think you're right on, okay? I think that situation has never been corrected, starting with the British way back when, okay? I buy that. The other thing is, are there any other forces or elements in the background that are trying to contribute to developing these kinds of situations? And that could be, who knows, the industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about, what have you. If you could speculate on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I certainly think that, you know, anyone here who has children or grandchildren in the military ought to be concerned about the types of weaponry we're acquiring, in the sense that we're now engaged with wars that are very manpower intensive, and instead we're buying airplanes that can't support the men on the ground, more aircraft carriers and submarines. So that I think there is a certain amount of, if not conspiracy, an inertia in the way we're looking at our relationship with the industrial base in this country, that we're buying a lot of weapons we don't really need. Another influence in the background, perhaps even stronger and more debilitating than the Israeli situation, is the Saudi lobby. The Saudis, at this time, are probably the most dangerous threat to the United States of any nation state. They are the swing producer for oil. They hold an enormous amount of our debt. And at the same time, they are exporting in our country and around the world a form of Islam that is much more anti-Christian, much more offensive-minded than anything Osama bin Laden stands for. And so I think there are a number of these problems. And quite frankly, I go back again to the American educational system. For people to, you know, I get graduate students that say we have to make them democracies because democracies don't fight each other. And I tend to remind them that 620,000 Americans died when two democracies fought each other on this continent in 1861 to 65. So I think there's lots of things out there that are working against the ability of the American government to defend Americans. But I also think, I'm grateful to all of you and all Americans for the career that I had. I had a tremendously positive career, and I resigned not because I had anything against the agency, but because I thought the 9/11 Commission had been a disaster, not finding anyone responsible for anything. What I wanted to say was the only dispiriting thing I encountered over the course of almost a 25-year career was to find out that protecting Americans very seldom comes first for the President of the United States. What comes first is they don't like to be criticized by the Washington Post or the New York Times. They love to be loved by the Europeans. Even President Bush, his actions to defend America in Iraq are moderated and tempered disastrously by his fear of what the Europeans are going to say. They're very worried about Muslim opinion. Next, very frequently, you don't do things to protect America because it will endanger a new oil or gas pipeline that's going through a place like from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan to Karachi. You don't kill Osama bin Laden because he's visiting a person whose father is going to buy $8 billion worth of F-16s. And when you get down the ladder, it's about sixth or seventh when protecting Americans comes into view. So I think we have a mindset, at least at the presidential level, where they're more interested in being citizens of the world than they are being citizens of our country.
I deduce from what you've said that you would advocate our withdrawal from NATO. And if so, what's the downside? And if not, why not?
I wouldn't say I would advocate the withdrawal from NATO. I would certainly advocate not expanding it to the point of being faced at some point with a situation of having to defend Albania. Important as that country is to our security, there's just a mindlessness in which we do things. The expansion of NATO is certainly one thing that has caused a rapid deterioration in the relationship between America and the Russians. And all the Russians, though the Russians aren't what they were, they're still a problem for us. And especially since they have such massive oil and gas resources. So I'm not one that believes that things never change. NATO was an extraordinarily effective organization within its in the parameters of the problem it was built to address. We see it, I think, being overexpanded. We certainly see it being used in places it was never intended to. The idea that NATO went to Afghanistan is probably going to be the death knell of NATO, because they have no business being there. But that comes from, in many ways, our country has become like a teenage girl. If you have a teenage girl and you go to the restaurant with their friends, you know, they can't go to the bathroom by themselves. They have to go as a group. And it's kind of become that. America is attacked on 9/11. It's an act of war against the United States. We bill it as an act of, you know, a gangster act against Western civilization. And then we line up all the little allies like Goslings and go off to fight. Well, it takes time to do that. But more realistically, the President of the United States after 9/11 had a window for savagery insofar as the American people were concerned. He could have done virtually anything he wanted to do militarily for about a year. But we took the Europeans, and some of them don't fight. Some of them dig wells and inoculate children. Others of them fight with rules of engagement that make them virtually a Boy Scout with a hammer. And so it really limits our ability to protect ourselves. So for all of those reasons, I think the time for NATO has probably passed. And the time for the Europeans to defend themselves, if they need to be defended, ought to fall on their shoulders, not on yours.
Mr. Choi, first I'd like to say that notwithstanding the New York Times, I think your book is absolutely excellent.
Well, thank
you. You've done a good job here this morning of summarizing it, and if you read the book, it's much more detailed.
Thank you, sir.
My question would be, we keep hearing that if we do pull out of Iraq, that Al-Qaeda will take it over, that it'll be a new base for them, and they'll train and so on. Do you feel that that's true?
No, sir, they'll never take over. One of the things that has been very apparent is that this administration's use of Al-Qaeda as the bogeyman in Iraq has sort of blurred the American people's ability to understand what's going on. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was never more than a small portion of that insurgency. Any insurgency can only thrive and exist if it's run by the local people. That's an Iraqi insurgency. And what you haven't been told by either party is that Iraq or Al-Qaeda went to Iraq for two reasons. First, it's an organization that was established in the late 80s to support other Islamist insurgencies. They go to Mindanao, they go to Kashmir, they're in Yemen, they're in Eritrea, they're in Chechnya. Not in big numbers, but they provide assistance. But what they went to Iraq for was contiguous territory to the Levant. Bin Laden grew up, if you will, or learned his business in the war against the Soviets. And essential to that war in Afghanistan was the fact the Afghans never had to stand and fight. They could always go back across the border into Pakistan, rest, refit, retrain, rearm, see their families. And he's been very public about it. He said, the reason I couldn't go to Bosnia, Al-Qaeda couldn't go to Bosnia, was I couldn't base in Catholic Croatia or Orthodox Serbia. So they sent money and a few trainers, but they didn't go there in a big way. Same thing about Israel. He has continuously and publicly railed against the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Lebanese for not letting him base in those countries to attack the Israelis. Well, for the first time, because of our invasion of Iraq and our destruction of Saddam, they are now, as you can see from reading the media, they're very active in Lebanon. They're certainly very active in Jordan. The Syrians have a problem with Islam, Islamism. And I think perhaps most tellingly, the Israelis say that they've established a presence in Gaza. So the success, Al-Qaeda is a success in Iraq simply because of they're now established there on a contiguous border. They can operate in the manner that they like to operate in. And also, quite frankly, they now have contiguous territory that allows them to begin to influence Turkey and the Arabian Peninsula. So all of those things are very important to them. And whether or not they get eliminated militarily in Iraq, those bases will be there in Sunni areas. And as long as they're going against toward the Israelis, they'll be supported. The bigger issue, I think one of the bigger issues that's never talked about is that Saddam Hussein was an indispensable ally in our war against this Al-Qaeda and what it represents. As long as he was in power in Iraq, the jihadis were trapped in South Asia. They were going to stay in Pakistan. They were going to stay in Afghanistan in the Persian Gulf area. They weren't coming west. He was hell on wheels when it came to those folks. Did he support terrorists? Yeah, he did. He supported the terrorists that attacked the Israelis. He was a very strong supporter of the Palestinians, but he wasn't supporting Al-Qaeda. He was the cork in the neck of the bottle. At least we had an isolated problem. Now we have a problem that's moved 2,500 kilometers west. We're seeing its impact in the Levant, across of North Africa, and into Europe. So it's a genuine problem for us, which we have not really, I don't think we've squared with the American people on it. And of course, it's not very popular to say Saddam was a good ally. But he was the best kind. We didn't have to pay him. We didn't have to train him. We didn't have to cajole him. Go ahead.
You indicated that you supported increased restrictions on our borders. And I wanted to see if you could flesh out some of the particulars of that, because I want to see exactly how that would not ostracize and possibly polarize us against the possible Islamic allies, such as Turkey.
Well, you know, there's a very good article in 2002 by a professor from Columbia. His name is Richard Betts, and he said it's only in America that the U.S. military wouldn't think that protecting territorial sovereignty was a responsibility. The way you close the borders initially is to use the U.S. military to close them. I probably do live in the late 19th century. I was invited about a month ago to go to Los Angeles to participate in a debate on, is border control part of national security? And they had me take the part that said, well, yeah, it's, you know, part of your sovereignty is controlling your borders. But I have to say, there was 600 or 700 people in the auditorium, and they all looked at me like I had 9 instead of my usual 7 heads. And Why would it offend Turkey? I don't get that part of the question. I think, really, there's no reason not to control the borders. America needs immigrants. We have to have immigrants to continue to grow and to continue to progress. But there's no reason that can't be done in an orderly manner. We adopted two babies from Korea, and it was absolutely a pain in the neck to go through that paperwork and all the rest of it to get a three-month-old and a four-month-old, and neither of them had an AK, into this country. I'm kind of hard over on it. I don't think anybody should get into this country unless they go through a process.
Sir, I was wondering, as a part of this group with gray hair, as to what you think we could do as grassroots or to get these things out so that the political people can be talking about the foreign policies, to get our TV people, our radio people. What can this group do? We can listen, but what kind of action should we be doing?
You know, I'm at a loss to answer that with any kind of satisfactory answer. I write letters to my congressmen and senators. I don't know if they have any effect, but I think that's an important thing to do. I think it's an important thing to go to meetings with politicians at all levels and make the impression. But I'm afraid that my bottom answer is that I'm a little bit pessimistic about it. I don't think that anything is going to change until we have not 3,000 dead Americans in our country, but 30,000 dead Americans in our country. And then people will begin to say, there's something wrong here. It's not it's probably a facile analogy, but what we're doing about conservation and fuel control, or using less gas, is until the big spike in prices, has been coming from the bottom up. It's people driving less, driving hybrids, the American people taking care of itself and not waiting for their leaders. And I think that until we have another disaster in this country, we're going to float along as we are, because the politicians, well, you can, in some ways, if your sole goal in life is to stay in office, you can't blame them for not talking about these things. You know, the way the world works in America is, to oppose Israel publicly as a politician is what the Muslims would call a martyrdom operation. You would be done. Or to say we're supporting the Saudis so they can continue, we're risking your kid's life to support the Saudis so they can continue stealing 90% of the revenue from their country and send it to Switzerland, is probably not another thing that would win many votes, or maybe it would. But I don't know. It's going to take a brain bigger than mine to figure out how we affect a system that seems to be, at least to me, to be so dangerous to our future security.
That's not true. A much better answer to that question is, attend forums like this. Use what used to be telegrams. Today it's emails. When those things come stacking in on the politician's desk, they listen. I promise you they listen. And that's the way you make a change. And you have that change opportunity in Virginia because you've got congressmen who are doing exactly what he says is bad. And they're not hearing from you. Up to them.
Yeah, they are.
You know, and it exposes my 19th century status, because in what I just said, emails never occurred to me, sir. So I very much appreciate that.
It's good political action advice from one of Virginia's distinguished former governors, Linwood Holton. Thank you, Governor.
Many of the hardliners in the war on Iraq have turned into redliners, saying that the United States should set up, absolute limits on activities in foreign country, or we will have consequences for them. In an era of intelligence that's not so good, from VX in Mogadishu to uranium from Niger to claims that there was actual radioactive material at the Syrian facility, have red lines lost their meaning? I mean, is it worthwhile or not?
You know, I'm not an expert on nation states and all of America's foreign relations, but we certainly have lost any ability to intimidate the Islamists, they kind of laugh at us. It's very politically incorrect to say, but in the Islamic world, force is a lingua franca. And people expect the government to use force. You know, part of the reason from the CIA's perspective that it's so difficult to catch these guys is they all grew up in police states. They're all running from the time they're 12 or 14 from security services and police services and all kinds of things. So they're very good at that. But more importantly, in the culture of at least Arab Islam, strength is respected, and a strong person who won't defend himself is held in contempt. And at least from our enemy's perspective at the moment, the world's greatest superpower has been very genteel in its application of force. So I don't think red lines for this particular enemy mean too much. I also think realistically, if you listen to Secretary Gates and some of the generals, which is very public, it goes around the world on the internet, the enemy knows that we are stretched to the breaking point, that the only reason the military hasn't cracked is that the United States government has engaged in the shameful practice, from my perspective, of fielding mercenaries. So the red line business is, I think, going a little by the boards at the moment, although they may attack the Iranians. You know, I think all of the talk recently about suddenly General Hayden, who's been a very, very honest, frank man, who said 2 weeks ago all of a sudden that Al-Qaeda is not a worry anymore, that seems to me to be just trying to avoid the problem they faced when they hit Iraq, that they hadn't destroyed Al-Qaeda first. So I think I don't think red lines mean an awful lot, except in nation-state relationships. That we could still crush the Russians if we needed to.
Our closing question.
Ooh, that has a lot of power. I appreciate your bold and robust observations, but as a mother of a military officer deployed for the second time currently, and I wonder what you say to the young men and women who are serving so well, who also wonder and have the observations that you have as well.
Well, they certainly deserve better of all of us in terms of the politicians we elect, and they deserve better than having a commander-in-chief from either party who is more concerned with avoiding international criticism than making sure that as many of his soldiers come back alive as he can. I think the truth is very important. These young men and women who serve us overseas are not stupid people. They're, in many ways, they come, the officer corps and many of the enlisted people are the best and the brightest. And I work quite closely with some of the special forces and with the Marine Corps, talking to young intelligence officers, non-coms and lieutenants, some captains. They know what this is about. It's very clear to them that this has nothing to do with women in the workplace and me having a pitcher of beer after work, that it's not about how we live, it's about what we do. And I've had numerous young Marines and soldiers say, listen, we go there, they ask us why we're there, and, well, we're there to bring you freedom and democracy and all these things. And the Afghans or the Iraqis say, we don't need it. You don't have anything that we want. So if we think somehow our soldiers and Marines don't know that they're being sent on a mission that is, first of all, usually repellent to the locals, and second, impossible to achieve, I think we're kidding ourselves.
Let me ask that everyone stay in their spot at the end of the forum and give Mr. Shorier the opportunity to exit the room and get over to where he's going to be signing books. Please join me in thanking Michael Shorier.
Thank you all.